since I stood here 12 months ago, I found that, you know, quite incredible things have happened, and incredible things have happened to me. I know that a couple of people have said, like, well done, Alan, thanks very much. I don't really attribute to so much to me. I attribute it to you lot. Because, you know, whether I was a leader or whether I wasn't the leader, you know, the people who were following the leader are the important people. And I've seen over the last 12 months, I've seen people springing up as leaders all over the country, in different parts of the country. And I'd like to send my thanks and appreciation out to them. It was when I stood here last year. It was before the general election. The general election was postponed for a month. I didn't realise where the campaign was going to take me. As far as I was concerned, I was just campaigning. I was just trying to do my best. And somehow I ended up in this situation. I think that the presence of the LCA candidates in the election and the votes they received was one of the main causes of a really quite sudden change in attitude, almost a U-turn from the British government. So all of a sudden we were rid of Jack Straw, the man with no heart, and we get a Home Secretary who sort of seems to have a little bit more sympathy with people, a little bit more maybe understanding with people. And the Labour government, you know, are starting to give way to this incredible force. The LCA is one of the political forces. We've also had reports from people like the Police Foundation and so on. But I think that those people that stood last year, like I say, they were very, very brave people. They put themselves up front. Many of them were, or some of them were, disabled people. You know, most of them didn't have any money. Few of us had experience. Yeah, there's a granny, Leslie von Goertz, who's very, very right wing. You know, is very much distant from the rest of us in her politics and her lifestyle. She's been a teacher all her life. She was pro-life, totally anti-abortion, for under any circumstances whatsoever, even health reasons. She was pro-monarchy. A royalist, you know, and she was also anti-World Bank and stuff like that. And she's totally in favour of total legalisation, total freedom of the herb, you know, for medical reasons, for recreational reasons. She's actually a sister of a doctor, Dr. Anne Beazenac, or Beazenac, in Liverpool, and Dr. Anne was prosecuted in 1991 or 1992 for supplying cannabis to her daughter, because her daughter has medical conditions that we don't really know about, because it's still it's her privacy, you know. But her conditions were quite serious, and rather than leave her daughter go out on the streets and buy cannabis, the doctor decided to get it for her and make sure it was good stuff. Eventually she was prosecuted, and she was one of the first people, the only doctor I know in Britain, who went to court and contested the prosecution, the allegation that she was guilty of misusing a drug, which is, of course, what the Misuse of Drugs Act is about. She said, no, this is not a misuse of a drug, this is a use of a drug, and she actually got not guilty, which was quite incredible in those days. And this lady in the north of Scotland, Leslie von Goertz, is a sister. She came recommended from Dr. Anne. We did go through a little bit of a sort of discussion about whether we should allow her to sort of stand, because obviously, you know, her politics is a little bit different from ours, and she actually offended some of the other candidates. And but basically, you know, the LCA is a cross-party issue, you know, and we felt that if there was going to be we didn't know for sure that Labour were going to get in. If there was a right-wing government get in, you know, how are we going to make the right-wing government, you know, listen to us if we're not willing to talk to them? We're not willing to let them stand up and say, legalise cannabis. It's a cross-party issue. People come from all walks of life. She came from that walk of life. And so we said, well, we'll let it stand. and she gained about 500 votes. She was actually one of the lowest vote counts in the country, but she gained 500 votes from her bed because she's disabled. She's 76 years old, you know, and speaking to her on the phone, and people who met her said, yeah, she's a nice old lady with some weird political views, but she agrees with us. And good luck to her on the legalised cannabis issue. The percentage of the vote last year varied from like 1% to 7.5%. That's in a local election. You know, strangely enough, you know, there was a local election up there in Widnes, and it was a little bit of a, maybe it's a lesson to be learned, because the lady who was standing in Widnes, Emma, she's over there. I mean, she said she wanted to stand, and we said, yes, great, you know, and we've authorised the certificate and everything for May, and the election was postponed, you know, and from that point, we sort of lost touch somehow. What happened, the election was postponed in June, and about a week after the election, I had a phone call saying, oh, I got 7.5% of the vote, and this was from a candidate who not only didn't have any money or any experience, you know, but she didn't actually get any support from us. She wasn't on the website. We weren't pushing her name because we assumed she wasn't standing. So it's incredible what people can do, you know, with no resources. The whole election last year, like I said earlier, you know, that we managed to get a friendly printer who printed a lot of the flyers for nothing. You know, my election in Spencer's in Norwich, on top of that, apart from the 500 deposit, I spent £150. You know, that is typical. Some of the candidates didn't even spend that. You know, we achieved that result on nothing. We achieved that result with no publicity on the television, no party political broadcast, hardly anything in the newspapers, you know, no money to back us. The first time we'd ever stood in a general election, inexperienced politicians and so on, often in constituencies where there were people like Green Party candidates and Socialist Alliance candidates and Liberal Party candidates, not so much Lib Dems, but Liberal Party candidates, who were also calling for the legalisation of cannabis. And we still managed to get what I believe is a lot of support from people out there who are fed up with party politics, and if they don't have any faith in elections, and maybe they came out and they voted for us. I think it was an incredible achievement, and I think the Labour Party realises it was an incredible achievement as well. So I'm pleased with the results, you know, and I'm glad to see the other parties calling for legalisation. I mean, that's one of the things we're trying to do. If every party in the country calls for legalisation, if somebody still wants to stand for the LCA, we'll go ahead. But if everybody stands for legalisation, every party adopts it as a policy, great. You know, if they say it all and to satisfy us, you know, that they're saying, they're giving our message out there, so we don't have to do it anymore, great. Because I'd love to go on holiday, you know. It's quite stressful. So I congratulate those candidates and those parties, and also the Scottish Socialist Party and Plaid Cymru in Wales and the Liberal Party, who've all adopted a policy of legalisation, although some of them don't recognise that it is such an important issue and they don't prioritise it. It's merely one of their policies. Where my disappointment lies with those people is that they haven't always recognised the full potential of hemp. You know, hemp's just another name for cannabis, really. But when we talk about hemp, we're talking about the fibre. We're talking about its use for paper, so we don't have to use dioxins to make paper from wood pulp, and we'll save the environment. One of the biggest potential uses of cannabis hemp is the use as a fuel. And there's a little sticker. You see, we've got these LCA stickers, and you've probably seen No Victim, No Crime stickers. There was another sticker that said, free medicine, free fuel. The fact is that we are being held to ransom by pharmaceutical companies and petrochemical companies who are prepared to go to war with Iraq and God knows where, and the Falkland Islands. Why did we fight in the Falkland Islands? It wasn't over sheep, you know, it was over oil. But they want that oil, they want to bleed the planet. You know, the alternative is that you could grow this plant, cannabis. You know, if you grow it well, and the tops and the heads of the plants are such good value as medicine, and such good value as for fun, you know, so that they can be sold. If a farmer, you know, ends up getting like 30 or 40 pounds a plant, they're going to be, you know, rolling in laughter, you know, they're going to love it, you know, and the rest of the plant can be dumped in, you know, on the compost heap, or using a very simple process, we can convert it into fuel that can be used to run cars, fuel that can be used to run jet planes, fuel that can be used to warm our houses up, you know, and to provide us with electricity. And in actual fact, because it's all waste product, it's virtually free. They can make so much money from the bud, the rest of the plant, the process of converting it into alcohol, the cost of that is virtually nil. Obviously, the government's going to tax it. You know, we're still going to be paying for our petrol. You know, they're going to tax it. But if they put that tax on it, you know, one of the things that the bonus is that they make the money from the tax, but they're not polluting the atmosphere. They're not polluting. They're not making people ill. So as it's happening at the moment, so they'll be able to use the tax on better things. You know, other than just cleaning the place up. So I'm pushing, you know, for all the values of cannabis to be recognised by all of these parties. I think that, you know, it's not just about sick people. You know, I have every sympathy with sick people, and some of them have a very urgent need for this plant. It's not just about my freedom to smoke. Well, I don't smoke tobacco anymore, so I won't say a joint, but a spliff. Or a pipe, right? It's not just about that, because if I want to take my pipe out now and smoke it, I will. You know, if I want to smoke the stuff, I will. I do smoke the stuff. I've been smoking the stuff for 30 years. I've been to prison. I got a 10-year prison sentence. I went to maximum security prison. As far as I know, you know, in any serious way, I've never hurt anybody in my life. I was used to sell cannabis. And if you've got a lot of cannabis, some of it might be good, especially if it's in bars, and some of it might be crap, might be harmful, might be horrible. If we got anything like that, we used to, you know, I'd bring it back, we'd give you money back, and we'll give it back to the dealer. And there was one time when I said to him, take it back to Holland. He'd brought it from Holland. He said, I can't do that. He said, well, what good can I do with it in Holland? I said, well, dump it in the North Sea, you know. But no, don't dump it in the North Sea, because then the fishermen down in Lowestoft will find it and then they'll sell it, you know. Burn it, throw it away. I don't care what you do with it. Well, we were not in the business of selling stuff like that. We were in the business of selling stuff that we liked to consume, that we enjoyed, that we felt good with, that we felt it was clean. Of course, we didn't have the equipment to be able to say categorically, this is good stuff, you know, which is another reason to legalise it. Because if it was legal, you could take your bit of whatever to some laboratory, and for virtually, you know, very small cost, you could get it analysed, and then you could go back to the shop or the person you bought it from and say, well, this is 99% cannabis, but there's 1% aspirin in it. I don't want that. I don't want 1% aspirin. I don't want boot polish. I don't care if it's black, white, brown, green. If it smokes nice and it makes me feel good, that's what I want, and that's what we wanted to supply people. We were not in the business of simply doing it to make loads of money, although I did make some money, you know, I had a good time out of it. I used to have people saying, thanks very much, you know, it's great stuff, I'll have some more next week. I went through that whole process. Eventually I was arrested, you know, as part of a ring, the big money gang they called us, because they didn't find much cannabis. You know, they had to call us something. They can call us big drugs gang, because we didn't have any big drugs. So we were a big money gang. And we were arrested. I was bunged up Knox Road in the prison for just over 12 months on remand. But there was no evidence. not real evidence. And I went through this process of applying for bail and applying for bail. We were locked up. It went on and on and on. We ended up going to the High Court in London because there's things called custody time limits in Britain. They can only keep you locked up so long without a trial. But the High Court in London was just about to say, yeah, let them go. And all of a sudden, we're committed to Crown Court. We're on another custody time limit. That doesn't apply anymore. It ended up we went to the High Court again, and we were granted a certificate saying that we've been in unlawful custody for 19 weeks. In other words, the government committed a crime against us, me and my co-defendants.
What year was it?
This was 1991. We went, all of a sudden there was the cell door was opened. You're off to court, you know. So we go to court and the judge says, most unsatisfactory. I see you've got unlawful custody and you've got unconditional bail granted to you by the High Court in London. That is most unsatisfactory. I can't do anything about that. But what I can do, I can put conditions on you keeping bail. So I had unconditional bail. 2 minutes later, I'm now to keep the bail, I've got to report twice a day at the police station, surrender my passport. I said, can I go down to the local police station? No, it has to be in the middle of Norwich, between 8 and 9 in the morning and 7 and 8 in the evening. I went up the police station. I signed for bail, and the cop said, whatever you've done. He said, I've never seen this before, twice a day, whatever you've done. I said, well, I haven't done anything. He said, well, you must have done something. I said, well, they say I did, but I haven't hurt anyone. So he said, well, it must be, he said, you don't look like a terrorist. I'm not a terrorist. He said, well, it must be drugs then. I went, getting warm, you know. Heroin? There's obviously a lot of heroin. No. I said, it's cannabis. It's cannabis. He said, however much did you get caught with? All right. I said, well, it's a nice round number. None. I wasn't even caught with a trace. I didn't have any pipes. I didn't have any, like, vast sums of money. You know, I didn't have any scales. I was just in the middle of a conspiracy charge. I was charged with conspiracy to import and supply cannabis because all these other people who had little bits of this and bits of that and money and so on, they had my phone number, basically. So I'm in the middle of it. I was guilty, you know. I fought it. Eventually I went to Crown Court and I stood in the witness box 3 days, you know. I told a few lies. Because I had to, you know, because I was trying to save my life. You know, I'd already been in prison for 12 months. I didn't want to go to prison for 20 years. You know, so I thought, well, swear on the Bible or not. You know, and I looked at it, and it said, Gospel according to St. John. And I thought, well, it's not even the Bible. This guy's wearing a wig. So, I mean, I don't even know if he's got his trousers on. He's falling asleep. These people who are talking and accusing me of this and accusing me of that, you know, and the guy who's defending me as well, they're all in pantomime. You know, it's just totally ridiculous. I looked at the jury. I mean, there was a guy with a Pink Floyd T-shirt on. I thought, well, he'll find me not guilty. You know, longish hair. I went through this process. I made a fatal mistake of looking at my co-defendants in the dock, and I had to put my hand up to my mouth because I was laughing. 3.5 days of going through this and going through that and going through this, and my barrister said, "Yeah, you know, we've won a lot of points today. I think you'll be found not guilty." We were sent down. The jury sent out. The judge said to the jury, he said, "When you come back tomorrow." He said, bring an overnight bag and make sure you don't park at a meter because you're not going to reach a decision tomorrow. You'll have to stay in a hotel overnight. So at this point, I was on bail, you see, because I'd been in this unlawful custody thing. So I was going back and forth to court every day. So we went out lunchtime, and we went back, and then he adjourned it till the next day. But the next morning we went in, and by the way, at this point one of my codees had disappeared, run off. So there was about five of us there. So we went in the next day, and the judge said, "Oh, I'll just remind you of what's happened. You know, just sum up." And he comes to talk about me. He said, "Oh, he tripped himself up there," you know, as if to say, "Find him guilty." So the jury's sent out. All of a sudden, we're back down in the cells now, waiting for the jury to come back. 10 minutes later, we're back in court. I'm unanimously guilty. Yeah, I was guilty of conspiracy to supply and conspiracy to import. It might have been that the jury thought, as was suggested at one point, that I was really the message boy and the coffee boy, you know, and people just used my phone. And so I was part of this ring. I was guilty of conspiracy. Once they found me guilty, some of my codees were found not guilty, some were found guilty. Eventually, 2 months, I was locked up again. 2 months later, I went to court, and the judge said, there's four people here, right? Me, a Scottish gentleman who had absconded, and so he hadn't been tried, a German chap who'd, the German police had been to him at his house in Germany and searched it, and they didn't find any evidence at all on him, so he was, you know, they wouldn't arrest him. He hadn't been to England. Police had said if he came over here, they'd arrest him. So I couldn't call him as a witness because his freedom was at stake. And another German who had been through a trial and been found not guilty. So we've got one who's absconded, one who's been found not guilty, one who's never been to court, and me. Right, these men are guilty of conspiracy, and they made £350,000. My share of that was £65,000. I had some money in the bank, which was legitimate money, and the judge accepted that was legitimate money. Right, so I had this money in the bank, and he said, you've made £65,000, and because we can't find it, because there's no trace of you putting it anywhere or even spending it, we're going to take the money that you've got. So I had to pay £15,000. This isn't the exact figure, but it was something like £15,395.69. Right, so I had to pay that, and I got 2 10-year prison sentences concurrent. I'm already locked up, and I spend this time in prison, and I managed to make use of my time. I wrote books, I read a lot, I learnt the computers and stuff like that, and I don't regret a day of it. It was fantastic, and thank you very much, you know, to Harry Anslinger for bringing this along, you know, because as somebody said earlier, if it wasn't for Harry Anslinger, I wouldn't be here. You know, if it wasn't for the likes of Tony Blair, I wouldn't be here. And it is hard work, and it does wind me up, but I enjoy it. So we've got this. We've got these uses of cannabis, like I say. You know, if we want, and most of us here would agree. If you want to have a smoke, you have a smoke. You know. The law's being changed, probably. It's going to be recategorized as a Class C, which means that they don't have to arrest you, but they can if they want under the Police and Criminal Evidence Act. They can still arrest you. If they arrest you, they can search your house. Alternatively, they can give you a summons to appear in court later, or they can just give you a good tell it off and don't do it again, and I'll have that, and they'll take your weed off you. And you know, that's too much punishment as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. We have to tackle the question of supply. But the other side of cannabis, right, is not to do with anything to do really with us in this room today, whether we're well, sick, whether we smoke or don't smoke, whether we're crooks or whatever. The real issue of cannabis is 100 years' time. 250 years' time. Our children's children, right? Those companies and those governments that are allowing the world to be polluted, I used to think, why are they doing that? Because their children's children, they're going to need the gas masks and the purified water as well. And then I thought, yeah, but they're making all the money out of polluting the world, and then they're going to make money out of selling us the gas masks and the water, or selling it to our children. They put chemicals in our water supply, and then they sell us water filters to take them out. You know, they use fuel that poisons people, and they use drugs that poison people instead of a nice herb. And those people end up in hospital taking more drugs so they can recover from the drugs that they took in the first place. So they get chest problems. A cannabis smoker gets a chest problem and they blame it on cannabis. You know, what about the cars? What about all the people that don't smoke cannabis and chest problems? It's a major problem. We've got to look to the future. But the main thing for me about the Alliance is, I mean, I was on a radio debate, and I didn't know who I was going to be debating with at the time. It was Radio Leeds or something. Paul Betts, the unfortunate father who lost his daughter to apparently a concoction of drugs, including ecstasy. And he said, well, Alan's a very selfish man. You know, he's only campaigning so he can have a smoke, and he can, you know, he won't get arrested for his habit. And it was so abusive that the radio DJ let me come back on it, and I said, well, I've never met Paul Betts in my life. I've never written to him, I've never talked to him on the telephone. What does he know about me and my habits? You know, what does he know about my selfishness? I'm doing this to save people like your daughter, to save them from these ignorance, that all the harm that comes from cannabis and from drugs is mostly due to ignorance, that the government refuses to tackle the issue. And that's why we're fighting. There's a resistance to legalisation. Look at who's putting money. There's a group in America called the Partnership for a Drug-Free America. And they fight tooth and nail to keep cannabis illegal. Our annual budget, the LCA in Britain, and if you add on to that, the other campaigns, the annual budget is probably about £10,000. This group in America, the Partnership for Drug Free America, they've got millions of pounds. Where does the millions of pounds come from? Beecham's. They make drugs. They sell drugs. Right, Smith Kline. They sell drugs. Right? Budweiser, that's a drug. Alcohol. Jim Beam, that's a drug. Philip Morris, American Tobacco, that's a drug. If you buy these products, by the way, you're giving them money to give towards the prohibitionists. That's a matter of choice. But the sad thing, you know, for a lot of people is Coca-Cola. Caffeine, it's another drug. They want us to buy their recreational substances, their medicines, their petrol, their plastic, their paper. We can grow our own. Thank you very much. We can grow our own. In Norwich, we can grow our own fuel. We can grow our own medicine. We can make our own paper. We can put our own smiles on our own faces, that we can feel good without falling all over the place and without getting abusive. So the cannabis is a plant for the people. That's what we need to do. Cannabis is a plant for the people. It's the people who are important. The government puts big industry before people. That's wrong. There's something terrible wrong there. That's just part of the force we're up against. We're also up against, of course, people who make profit out of selling cannabis and bad cannabis and introduce people to hard drugs. So I just want to say, like, over the last year, briefly, I've got a few minutes left, that, I went down to the Oxford Union. I mean, this came out of the blue. All of a sudden, they want somebody, or they wanted me, as somebody from the Alliance, to go down and debate on the issue of legalising cannabis. This House would legalise cannabis, straightforward sort of motion. So you had to wear a black tie or a lounge suit, Well, I mean, I don't even know what black tie. I thought you wore black tie to a funeral. I'm not in. I don't know about things like that. Lounge suits, whatever's a lounge suit. I had to look it up in the dictionary. But I ended up buying a suit. So I go down in my suit and tie, and I sit there. Peter Lilly, MP, Conservative Party. John Owen Jones, MP, Labour Party. Professor Iverson, Professor of Pharmacology at Oxford University. I think he was a Lib Dem, right? And me. And we're all on the same side. And we're all saying the same thing. And we're all totally different people from different backgrounds. And what was the opposition? The people who spoke against us. Well, I'm sure they could have found somebody better than that. There was Dr. Tom Stoppard, right, who had to sort of hold himself up because he'd been drinking so much. He said, Alan's wrong when he says that cannabis is relatively safe. He said, it's very dangerous. He said, I know a lady who had one joint and she's been in a mental hospital for the rest of her life. He said, it shrinks your testicles. It makes you become more feminine. It gives you feminine attributes like long hair. Yeah, well, I didn't have any witnesses there, you know, but they haven't shrunk. Peter Hitchin. Well, we had Commander Paddock from Brixton was there, and he was supposed to be speaking in the opposition, but he changed his mind and he decided he'd stand in the middle and just report about Brixton. So, of course, when I'm standing there, and I've done my blurb, and I've said, look, you know, am I frightened? Are you frightened? You know, 400-500 people, are you frightened? Am I frightening you? You know, am I threatening you? Well, if I've got some cannabis in my pocket, are you frightened? Am I threatening you? Are you a victim of my crime? And I said, you know, if you believe that I'm guilty, vote against the motion. If you believe that I'm not guilty, vote in favour of the motion. Peter Hitchin wanted Commander Paddock to arrest me. I was saying, yeah, please arrest me. It wouldn't be great to be arrested at the Oxford Union. He didn't arrest me. Peter Hitchin, we won the debate, 190 to about 120. We won the debate, and Peter Hitchin sort of stormed out. He didn't even stay for a drink afterwards. So very quickly, to carry on with this, very quickly, you know, from Oxford, I ended up in Trafalgar Square, speaking to a load of people, the first time in my life I've done anything like that. And then I got called down to the Home Affairs Committee, who were investigating government drug policy. I must have been one of the first ex-convicts to do that, although one of many hundreds of criminals to do that sort of thing, to the Home Affairs Committee, because most of the people who testify before them are criminals in one way or another, and I was unlucky enough to have been caught. But maybe they listened, you know, maybe they listened, because their report is due out soon, and I think it's going to support declassification. I just told them what I thought was true and what I'd experienced in my life, and they asked some questions, and I tried to answer them. It didn't stop there, because from talking at this in this big debating chamber in Oxford to going to Trafalgar Square and then the House of Parliament and talking to them, the next thing I find is I'm sitting in between the police, the chief constable of Merseyside Police, and the chief of Stockport Health Executive. And a load of professors on a panel answering questions from probation officers, doctors, lawyers and police about the cannabis issue. And I can't find anything to argue with them about. This copper and you know, so on, they agree. They think it should be legal. That's their stance. Everybody agrees. Now, we can't find anybody to debate against us. And every time I get radio stations ringing me up saying, can you suggest somebody to take the other side, you know? Well, I can't, you know, not anybody sensible anyway. So I went along and I made it up on the spot and everything went well. I think people in this hall, they could do just as well. Because the thing is, you see, we're right. That's the key. We're right. We know what we're talking about. We're not guessing. We're right. Have the confidence, if anybody asks you, have the confidence. The people in this room, we're the ones who are going to do it. Stand up there and tell them the truth. Don't hide the truth. You don't have to tell them whether you smoke or not. That's irrelevant, you know. So I'm going to stop there and carry on this afternoon with the second bit. That's really the introduction to what I hope will be an interesting debate this afternoon. Thanks.